Earth's sky.
This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. I'm Jorge Salazar. We have a great show this week with top scientists from around the world. Here's a scientist soundbite.
We're trying to demonstrate the larger point that, yes, we can program bacteria to perform complex tasks, and these complex tasks can actually be quite useful in hopefully one day addressing an important environmental challenge.
That was Emory University professor Justin Gallivan. Lindsay Patterson has more on his story of engineered bacteria.
Thanks, Jorge. Justin Gallivan works in an emerging field of science called synthetic biology. It's like a combination of biology and engineering. So Gallivan is reprogramming bacteria to do specific things. For example, attack harmful chemicals that contaminate drinking water. So I asked him to explain the science of his research. Your work involves what scientists call reprogramming bacteria. What does it mean to reprogram a living organism?
All living things execute chemical programs that are encoded in their DNA. And if you change the DNA, you can change the behavior. So it's much like changing the code on your computer. So you can get your computer to do new things. You can also get organisms to do new things.
So can you explain some of the practical applications for these engineered bacteria?
We're developing these tools to allow us to turn genes on and off predictably. And in a bacterium, we might want to turn on the ability to break down a compound in the environment. We might want to turn on the ability to move towards specific compounds in the environment or to deliver drugs to the body and so on. So we're trying to switch on these programs using small molecules.
Your recent research involves the agricultural chemical atrazine. Can you tell me about that?
What we did was we developed a chemical switch known as a riboswitch that turns genes on in the presence of atrazine. And what we did was we used that switch to turn on a gene that makes bacteria move. And so when the cells see atrazine, they move towards it. And then by using a second gene that we took from a second bacterium, we could take the gene that allows that bacterium to break down atrazine, put it into our reprogrammed cell, and now we have cells that can actually seek atrazine and destroy it.
So someday scientists could release bacteria into the environment to clean up atrazine.
Well, yeah, that's the idea. But the reality is that engineered bacteria actually being released into the environment is really a long ways off. All the work that Gallivan's done so far has been in his lab, and he says that his bacteria are too weak to survive in the wild. But this field of synthetic biology does raise a lot of ethical concerns, and scientists and policymakers are actively debating how it should be handled.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Earth Sky is Lindsay Patterson, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. A story that matters to scientists on antimatter. Antimatter, described as the mirror image of ordinary matter that we can sense, has been more the stuff of science fiction than of science fact. Not much is known about it, and it's incredibly hard to isolate and contain. Speaking to us from his office at the University of Aarhus in Denmark is Jeffrey Hengst, one of the leading scientists in the world working on antimatter. He spoke with us about a breakthrough his lab made in briefly trapping antimatter. Dr. Hengst, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now tell us about the main findings of your recent experiments with antimatter, which you reported in the November 2010 edition of the journal Nature. What happened here?
Okay, what we've done here for the first time is to hold on to some antihydrogen atoms. Antihydrogen is the antimatter equivalent of the most basic element, hydrogen. And we've been producing antihydrogen at CERN since about 2002. What we've done here is to not just produce it, but to produce it in a trap, as we call it. It's kind of a magnetic bottle that can hold on to the antihydrogen so that it doesn't fly off and meet a cataclysmic fate by annihilating with normal matter.
Please explain for us what exactly is antimatter?
Okay. So everything around us is what we sort of rather arbitrarily refer to as matter, normal matter. And everything you come in contact with every day is just made of three particles, protons and neutrons in the nucleus of atoms and electrons, which orbit the nucleus. Back in the 1930s, an English physicist named Paul Dirac predicted that there could be a kind of a mirror image of matter, which has, for example, the same mass as a typical matter particle, but opposite charge and some other properties that are mirror reflected, if you will. Now, matter and antimatter aren't compatible. If they meet, you get annihilation. You produce some energy, which often produces more mass again. But as far as we understand, the laws of physics say that matter and antimatter should behave in the same way. In fact, when we produce matter in the laboratory or antimatter, they come as a pair. This is where Mr. Einstein comes in. What we do at laboratories like CERN is use E equals mc squared. We take some energy, E, and we use it to produce mass, M. Right? That's what that equation is about. If you have energy in the form of high-energy particles, you can use them to produce more mass, and we look for new things typically. But every time we produce mass from energy in the laboratory, we get equal amounts of matter and antimatter. So this brings up a big question about the origin of the universe, because if the Big Bang was an energy event, then there should have been equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the beginning of creation. It looks like the universe chose matter over antimatter. Again, the two are incompatible, but we don't really understand why the universe took a left turn instead of a right turn. And that's one of the mysteries about antimatter. That's one of the things that fascinates scientists about it.
That was physicist Jeffrey Hangst, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Today on Weird Science, Ryan Britton has a story about an artist who is literally blending man and machine all in the name of art. Ryan, what's up?
Well, this artist named Wafa Bilal, who is an assistant professor at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, has had a camera surgically implanted in the back of his head. He also set up this website called Third Eye, where in just days we will start to hopefully see pictures from the back of his head. This all starts on December 15th.
Ryan, why is Dr. Bilal doing this?
Well, as you said, he says he's doing it in the name of art. Their camera will capture images at one-minute intervals 24 hours a day and upload them to monitors at the Mathaf Arab Museum of Modern Art in Qatar. So I'm hoping we can see some images on his website that can be found at www.3rdi.me. So that's thirdeye.me. Right now, there's just a countdown clock on the site.
So Dr. Bilal must be trying to make some kind of statement with a camera in the back of his head.
Right. We're not entirely sure what Bilal is trying to say with this quote-unquote installation. But according to the Wall Street Journal, he says he's chosen to have a camera put, you know, in the back of his head as an allegorical statement about the things we don't see and leave behind. So we should definitely stay tuned because Bilal is an artist who's been controversial in the past.
This camera's on even when he's sleeping.
That's right. 24 hours a day. I have thoughts of it being potentially somewhat, you know, boring when you see his pillow, maybe for that 8 hours of sleep. But you know, what's cool is that by definition, this installation of the camera makes him a cyborg or a cybernetic organism, which is a being with both biological and artificial parts. So, you know, yet another piece of science fiction coming true. Again, we'll know more on December 15th. So, you know, stay tuned. Hopefully images start to show up on the internet from the back of Bilal's head.
Okay, thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists around the world. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. As the seasons change across the globe, people are preparing to cool or warm their homes, and that comes with increased energy use. Emily Howard is here to talk more about how people can save energy this winter and summer and all year round. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Jorge. Thanks for having me. I recently spoke with Dr. Shazeen Attari of Columbia University, and she surveyed Americans in 34 states to better understand what they believe that they can do to save the most energy. Now, what Attari found is what Americans believe saves the most energy and what actually does often don't match up.
When we asked individuals right at the beginning of the study, what is the most effective thing that they could do to conserve energy, almost 20% of our participants stated turning off the lights. There was a lot of focus on curtailment, which is basically cutting back on activities, rather than energy efficiency, which is basically investing in home equipment.
Now, what that means is, while turning off the lights is great, it may not actually be the most energy efficient thing that people can do.
As much as you can, try to carpool with other people, buy and use a fuel efficient car, and weatherize your home. But just in general, whenever you're buying a new device, a new appliance, just always think of the energy efficiency of the device.
Which is something to keep in mind for seasonal sales. Other energy-saving tips include installing or upgrading attic insulation and ventilation, getting frequent car tune-ups, which this includes air filter changes, reducing the time spent flying, turning down the thermostat, and using heating or cooling in only one or two rooms in the house rather than the whole home. Also, switch from incandescent to fluorescent light bulbs.
Thanks, Emily.
My pleasure.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists. We go from energy savings to energy bubbles. Beth Lebwall with more.
Hey, thanks, Jorge. So in photos, the Milky Way galaxy, our home galaxy, typically looks like an immense dusty band of stars. But we might have to revise the picture. That's because in November of 2010, a team led by Harvard astrophysicist Doug Finkbeiner discovered two giant light-filled bubbles extending from the center of our galaxy. He said these bubbles are huge. Each one is about a third of the size of the visible Milky Way. These bubbles contain high-energy particles that produce gamma radiation.
Gamma radiation is just very high-energy light. These photons have something like a billion times as much energy as visible light photons.
In other words, light tremendously more powerful than sunlight or X-rays.
So this isn't visible light, is it?
No, it's actually not. Thanks for bringing that up. It's only visible if you have gamma X-ray vision, which most of us don't actually have.
Beth, how did Finkbeiner's team find these bubbles?
They used NASA's Fermi telescope, which sees in gamma rays. He said the bubbles have very distinct edges. In fact, put together, they look like a giant number 8 painted in the center of the galaxy.
To my eye, these bubbles have sharp edges. The edges are quite sharp compared to the size of the overall structure. And so it looks to me like something that's currently exploding. It looks like a shockwave propagating out from some burst of energy. You know, we live at a special time. We've caught this thing red-handed just after something's blown up.
Finkbeiner said scientists are throwing around two ideas about how these bubbles formed. One idea is that the black hole, which sits at the center of our galaxy, burped, spewing out light and electric particles at incredibly high speeds. Another idea is that a bunch of stars at the center of the Milky Way exploded all at once to form this rather unusual fireworks display. For a picture, you can actually visit our website, earthsky.org.
How old are these bubbles?
Well, Dr. Finkbeiner isn't exactly sure.
What seems clear is that they come from some kind of huge energy injection in the center of the galaxy at some point in the past. Whether it's 1 million or 10 million years, we don't know exactly, but some point in the past.
Why are scientists just spotting them now?
That's a really good question. It's because scientists have the right telescope, the Fermi telescope, which is floating out there in the heavens as we speak, and it specializes in gamma rays.
Astrophysicists have been looking at gamma rays for years, decades, but the machinery gets much better with each generation, of course. And so this current gamma-ray telescope, Fermi, is about 100 times more sensitive than its predecessor. Using this telescope is kind of like putting on your glasses for the first time.
I really liked how he put that. Very articulate fellow. Probably my favorite part of the interview was when he talked about the moment his team spotted the bubbles.
Well, there's a great quote from Isaac Asimov, where he says, "The sound of discovery is not, 'Eureka, I've found it!' It's, 'Hmm, that looks funny.'" And that's really how it was. You know, we were just staring at the computer screen. We said, "Well, that looks funny. I wonder if that edge is real."
The edge of the bubbles, that is.
Thanks, Beth. Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. We'll be right back. A clear voice for science. We interview the world's top scientists. Up next, a weather report on the science of forecasts. To scientists, weather is a daunting challenge because of its complexity. Small changes in one place can add up to big changes in another. Meteorologists rely on computer models to make reliable weather forecasts. And here to explain more is Ron Gilaro, lead scientist of atmospheric simulation for the Global Modeling and Assimilation Office at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. Dr. Gilaro, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Please explain for us, in a nutshell, what is a weather model?
A weather model is a computer program, a very complex computer program, that contains the equations and basic governing laws that dictate how different atmospheric parameters relate to each other, say how temperature relates to pressure, relates to winds, and most importantly, how these parameters or changes in these parameters in one parameter might affect the change in another parameter. So given a change in wind or pressure, how that might change the temperature. And this is our essential way of trying to understand the processes and the motions of the atmosphere.
Maybe you could tell us how scientists are doing in understanding Earth's weather and what are some of the challenges that keep them from completely understanding it.
Well, actually, our understanding of the weather is actually generally quite good, but it's also a function of the scale of the processes. We understand large-scale circulations, processes, and those sort of phenomena that are easy to observe. We understand those very well. In terms of our physical laws. As it gets to more complex processes as they relate to clouds or smaller motions, those we understand less well. But the basic problem with the atmosphere is there is really an inherent predictability limit. The atmosphere is what we call a chaotic system. What that means is that it's very difficult to come up with a regular cause and effect sort of relationship. It doesn't always respond in the same way to small perturbations. So that means you can make what seems like a very small error in your depiction of the atmosphere at a given moment, and that could become a very large error in a forecast. It's a lot of people have heard of the butterfly effect, where, you know, there's this folklore that can a butterfly flapping its wings in Beijing cause a rainstorm in Brazil. Well, it's not quite that bad, but it is sort of an anecdotal way of expressing the property the atmosphere has, where what seems like a very small change or perturbation at one moment in time can lead to a very sudden and dramatic change a very short time later. And that doesn't always happen, but it can happen. And unless we can model the atmosphere perfectly and observe the atmosphere perfectly, that's a limitation we'll never be able to get beyond. Now, we've made progress, but the atmosphere, for that reason, will never be entirely predictable.
That was Ron Gilaro of NASA. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Wiretree, The Georgian Company, My Education, Household Names, The Black and White Years, and Dana Falconberry. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.